All right, and we should be live now. Welcome, everybody. This is the July 2022 live money Q&A with the financial advisory firms that are endorsed by Wealthion. I'm joined here, as usual, by the lead partners from New Harbor Financial. That's John Lodra and Mike Preston. Hi, guys. How you doing?
Hello, Adam.
Hi, Adam. Thank you for having us. And hello to Michael as well, who will announce in a moment.
Yeah, so we're also joined by the folks from RIA Advisors. That seat's normally held here by Lance Roberts. You see him on this program with me every Saturday. Lance is out of the country on a well-deserved vacation. He didn't have good broadband access there, so he asked his partner, Michael Leibowitz, to sit in his stead, which honestly, Michael, I sort of see as an upgrade here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe we'll keep Lance in Italy for a little while.
Yeah, he can stay there as long as he likes. We're dealing with the A team here now. All right, everybody. Well, look, if you haven't watched one of these before, this is sort of an anything goes session here. Just ask any questions you have in the comments section, and I will be pulling as best I can from them. Please be patient with us. We may not be able to get to every single question that gets asked, but I'll try to aggregate as many similar ones together to try to get as many of folks' key questions answered here. This will then become a video after the live part of its shot that'll be available for replay on YouTube. So if you don't get, don't worry about taking too many notes here furiously in the live session, because you'll be able to replay and rewatch things later on. All right. Well, guys, look, it's been a hell of a year so far. Right. One of the worst years ever, first half of the years ever for the combined equity and bond markets. We've seen cryptocurrencies get pummeled of late. We've seen commodities and commodity producers, which were the high flyers this year, begin to drop pretty precipitously. And we're now beginning to see the housing market roll over. So not a great start to the year for assets so far. I'm going to start getting to questions here, but real quick, and Michael Leibowitz, why don't we start with you, since it's your first time here? Do you have any sort of general, outlook to whether we've seen the worst and things may start to get better from here, or do we think that the beatings are going to continue until morale improves?
I think the beatings continue, and that's largely because I think this is being brought on by the Fed. The Fed is pulling liquidity out of the markets via low rates. They're starting to do quantitative tightening right now, so they're reducing their balance sheet. And as they do that, they're taking the froth out of the markets. They're also taking it out of the economy. So that's why we're seeing house pricing starting to go down. And I think when you start thinking about the markets for the next few months, even beyond that, the question to me is, what will the Fed do? And it's not necessarily what will they do, but how will their logic and their thinking change over time? And right now, based on their statement from last week, they appear gung-ho to raise rates at the meeting at the end of July, and they will continue forward with QT, which tells me that the trend will be lower. Now, it doesn't mean there won't be market bounces, but I believe the trend will be lower until we see something out of the Fed that says otherwise.
All right, great. And let's hear the New Harbor side of that. John, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Thank you. I agree very much with what Michael and Mike and I and the team at New Harbor agree very much with what Michael said there. This is a market that is digesting the forced, I would suggest, reversal of amazingly loose policies from the central bank and even fiscal policy in response to COVID, and the excesses that have been built into markets across virtually every market, stock market broadly, bond market, and certainly real estate as well. These excesses have been built up over more than a decade, and you might even say longer than that if you really want to kind of look at the big picture. So I think it'd be somewhat naive to think that this is a short kind of event here in terms of the impact of reversing some of these policies and what that likely means for the path of prices of stocks and bonds and real estate. We believe, again, just to emphasize, there's likely a trend significantly further down, but that it would be very much in line with history to see some sharp rallies back along the way, just to make things all that much more confusing and frustrating and scary, frankly, for a lot of people.
All right. Mike Preston, anything you want to add there before we get to the real kickoff question here?
Not much, Adam. I'd just like to say that the market topped in November of last year, if you look at the Wilshire 5000, the total market, and the S&P topped January 4th. So here we are a good 7 or 8 months into this bear market, and it's classic bear market behavior for most to think that the bottom is in or that we're not even in a bear market yet. It's been very stealthy. And I'd agree with what's said here, that the risk is to the downside and the bear market is likely not over. So the surprises will be to the downside. So we continue to preach an abundance of caution.
Okay. I'm going to pull a question here from user S. Bain, where he says, do you see the coming demand destruction causing lower inflation or higher inflation? And so, you know, the big story of the past year, year and a half, is that inflation has come roaring to 40-year highs, continues to remain elevated. We should get the new CPI numbers pretty soon. But until we do, we're stuck with the 8.6% last print, right, which is a 41-year high. I think a big question here is, you know, inflation going to continue to be a real problem here, or is it going to start moderating? And I've heard experts argue sort of both sides of that story. Let's see, Michael, why don't we give you a chance? Michael Leibowitz, why don't we give you a chance to kick off on that one, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, and that's a tough question. My quick answer is yes. I think that we are going to see demand backing off. And at the same time, the supply lines are the problems are easing quickly. So we'll get a normalization of supply and demand with demand coming down, and in some cases coming down sharply. So in that respect, yes, the problem is the way we measure inflation. And CPI is kind of the broadest, most followed measure of inflation. And within it are many different prices. About a third of it, maybe even more than a third now, is housing prices, rental prices and an approximate rental price based on house prices. House prices have been going up 20% a year. And the problem is, while we're starting to see the beginnings of some real problems in the housing market and housing pricing starting to slip, it takes a while for that to happen before it enters till it gets into the number. Same thing, it's not just housing, but housing's just, you know, more than a third of the number. For instance, we've seen metals prices dropping significantly, agriculture prices dropping significantly. That's not going to make its way into I think it's Wednesday's CPI number. You know, maybe we'll see a little bit of it in PPI, but it'll probably take another month to get into PPI and another month or two to get into CPI. So, yes, I think prices will be coming down, but some of it is depending on pricing and how long it takes for that to get into the data. And but over time, I do think we are peaking, if not have peaked already, in inflation, at least for the time being.
Okay. And sorry, just to sort of clarify, it sounds like you're saying CPI is sort of a backward looking data point, and we may actually see things moderate faster than the CPI is adjusting if we're just looking at
it. Yeah. I think if you had a real time measure of inflation, you would see inflation starting to come down already. But it takes a while for them to collect the data. You know, for instance, if you put your house on the market and you lower the price, that doesn't show up in anything until you sell it. And it takes a while to negotiate a sale. It takes a while from that sale to go from agreement to settlement when it gets picked up in the data sources. So it can take a few months for some of the very recent data that we're seeing to show up in the data.
Okay. New Harbor guys. Mike, why don't we start with you? Just thoughts on inflation, where it may be headed from here. And I'm asking this question as a stepping stone to a larger one about Fed policy.
Well, the truth is nobody knows for sure, but we've long thought that deflation was going to be in the cards. We're living through this epic bubble and everything. Valuations we think can be measured very reliably as being beyond the most extremes in U.S. history, even still. And so it's only natural to believe that we're going to see some kind of asset price crash, which is certainly deflationary. but nobody knows. It does seem like short term here, there's been a surprise inflationary uptick. And as Michael was just talking about, these data sets are slow moving. I still think it's likely that we see a deflationary asset crash. And there's also talk about debt jubilee and debt forgiveness. When you destroy debt, you're destroying an asset that's also deflationary. In a deflationary time, cash would be, the place to be. So my take is leaning heavily towards deflationary outcome.
All right. And sorry, John, I'm going to come to you with a related but different question here. This question is from Joshua Vance. And before I read it, let me just say, what we're seeing right now develop is the economy is slowing. We had negative GDP growth for Q1 and Q2 now, it looks like. You guys are using words like disinflation and deflation. The expectations that we might be heading into a recession seem to be kind of growing by the day here. And yet we have the Fed continuing to hike, saying, it's got to do what it needs to do to get inflation under control. So to the spirit of Josh's question here, is the Fed now being too hawkish, right? Is it in the process of making a policy mistake that as the economy is tipping into recession, it is pushing the economic brakes even harder, making the recession deeper than it may need to be otherwise?
It's a great question. This is a very complicated question, and the answers are intractable in some ways. I think the Fed obviously has a history of using their words to try to create results, perhaps doing the heavy lifting for the hard work that they know they probably need to do. So there's probably some part of their talking tough because they feel they have to. But I think there also is a realization, even though they've been somewhat, quite blind to the likelihood of inflation becoming a sudden and very, very big problem, even just a short while ago, a handful of months ago, there were folks, saying that inflation would not be a problem. And here we are. I think they also realize that history is not kind to once inflation becoming a problem, that it doesn't just solve itself quickly and easily. It takes a long time for this to kind of work its way and be removed from the system. And if you go back to the 70s, early 70s, and ultimately the early 80s, that is a perfect example where this is the case. I mean, the early 70s, 73, 74 was a very tough time in the stock market. Inflation was becoming a problem. The Fed was hiking into a recession. And we go back and study history, I think the consensus will be that they got too skittish too soon. They should have been more disciplined. And ultimately, what happened in the early 80s with interest rates going to double digits, money market rates were way, very high double digits, and Volcker had to come in and do the work that couldn't have been done due to backbone or otherwise. So I think there is probably. I don't think this is going to be a short-lived thing where, the Fed's going to be able to say, ooh, look at that. Inflation suddenly is not a problem. We can kind of go back to, supporting markets and not worrying about. I think this is going to be around for a while, and it's not going to work its way through quickly. I will say that the market, when I say the market, if you look at implied, inflation break-evens and things like that, the market has started to, in some measures, signal that inflation has peaked, but the market can get it wrong, especially when you have bond markets as intervened by central banks as they have been, even still, where we're just starting to have central banks kind of wean off their influence on bond markets.
All right. So Michael Leibowitz, let's get you to answer the question about, is the Fed making a policy mistake here by being too hawkish at this moment? And then I've got a follow-up question I'm going to ask you.
And I thought John addressed that well, and I would share many of those same thoughts. Are they too hawkish? It depends what the goal is. The Fed has indirectly blown up a bubble for the last 20, 30 years, allowing way too much unproductive debt into the economy. And a lot of that debt cannot be serviced without lower rates. So, yes, from the more traditional media point of view, the Fed is making a mistake. They're raising rates. They're creating more of a recession than would otherwise be. I would argue from a much longer perspective that we can't keep blowing up this bubble because it does have, it's only so limited until it really breaks where the consequences are even worse. So I think the Fed is doing the right thing. I think the Fed needs to raise rates more, and it will be painful. It's not going to be pleasant, but we need to get rid of some of the unproductive debt. We need to get rid of some of those zombie companies and zombie individuals that have solely relied on extremely low interest rates. So it's a tough question to answer, and I think it depends what seat you're in. But I think for the first time in a long time, the Fed is doing the right thing. Now, we'll see if they keep to it. I have my doubts since they are pretty quick to come to the rescue whenever some big bank or hedge fund starts failing.
Right. And I want to get to the rescue part in just a minute, but I'm curious, do you think they're doing the right thing for the right reasons or the right thing for the wrong reasons? Right. And an example of the latter would be they're doing it simply because inflation's too high and they feel like they've got to either at least optically or maybe even in real terms, try to get inflation under control, but they're not doing it to clear the malinvestment from the system of the decade, 1 to 2 decade long bubble that they blew.
Right. No, they're doing it purely to get inflation down. Inflation is politically, it's going to be very tough on the Democrats. It's very tough on the poor and middle class. And right now, their goal is to get inflation down. I don't think they have any desire to deal with the longer term debt problems this country faces.
Okay, so we're talking here then in early, getting near mid-July, when the earnings, the Q2 earnings releases are about to start coming out. And Mike and John from New Harbor, we've talked a little bit about this, where we're watching them closely because we think that there's good potential that companies are going to bring down their forward revenue and earnings projections based upon the slowing of the economy we just talked about, right? And that could precipitate another downward move in the markets as, you know, forward price targets for companies are adjusted. I'm just curious, start with you, Mike, what's your level of confidence that that's indeed what we're likely to see here? Do you think that's more likely than not?
Absolutely, Adam. I think that the earnings estimates are very rich. They're all based on everything going exactly right. And of course, don't forget the stimulus spending, both monetary policy and fiscal policy the last couple of years, it's extraordinary. You know, if you take a look at, revenues and earnings of the S&P 500 or the entire market, you can correlate it directly to deficit spending by the government, which was insane the last few years. So it's a very rosy picture that has to continue running perfectly. And we're starting to see things going in the other direction. I think that we're going to see earnings revisions downwards, and that will put pressure on the market.
Okay. John, you're nodding. Anything you want to add on top of that?
Yeah, I agree. One thing is, it's just one of many variables that go into this. The strength in the US dollar is another factor that could play out in the near term here is for earnings. I saw a stat today, I think it was a gentleman from Morgan Stanley talked about the strength in the US dollar, basically having a half point effect on earnings growth. So for example, he looked at the US dollar year over year was up 16%, I think was the number. And, in his calculation, that translates to an 8% headwind on earnings growth translation. So there's that factor too. It's just one of many, but I wanted to raise that as a point that was just on my radar. But yeah, the margins, it's funny. I make it a point to watching kind of more mainstream programs just to get a pulse on, so on Sunday I watched CBS This Morning or whatever they call it. And there was a spot on there about, it was entitled Greedflation. And it was obviously about inflation, but the question was, are corporations, taking advantage of the situation by price gouging and things like that. I certainly don't want to go there. I'm certainly an advocate of free markets but the point being is that there was a chart in there that I think Mike just talked about this. Corporate profit margins are at record levels for over the past decades. And that's one data series that reliably has been very mean reverting in history. So I think there's a whole lot of margin pressure that has yet to play out short and longer term in corporate margins.
All right. And I pulled up a related question here, John, as you were talking about the strength of the US dollar there. This is a little bit of, you know, some of what Brent Johnson has talked about with his dollar milkshake theory, which is as the US dollar strengthens, especially as economic growth globally starts to struggle, it places a disproportionate burden on other countries, particularly smaller countries that have a lot of US dollar denominated debt. It gets harder and harder for them to pay that back. And you see more collapse risk there, or correction risk there, than they necessarily do here. All right, so here's where I'm going with this question, and Mike Leibowitz, I'll ask it directly to you, which is, we see it, we agree that the beatings are gonna continue. We see this potential for our earnings disappointments, you know, this margin compression, this earnings recession that you guys have been writing about over there at RIA. That could be a near-term factor here. Again, we talked about recession. So the general question I have is before I ask you guys about what you think the impact of a Fed pivot might be, how bad do you think things may get in the markets for the rest of this year up until perhaps a Fed pivot?
I think that question, that's a tough question, because I think the Fed will, you know, if inflation drops like a rock over the next few months, the Fed will pivot. I have very little doubt, but I don't think inflation is going to drop like a rock. I think it will start abating. And, you know, maybe towards the end of the year, we start seeing 5%, 5.5% inflation, which is much better than the 8.5 or so we see now, but that's still not acceptable for the Fed. So I don't see them pivoting unless we have some kind of financial instability. So again, kind of think of 2008, think about 2012, when some of the European nations were struggling. I think we're going to have to see that. But if the markets can kind of manage to fall in a controlled way, and that's what we've seen so far, it hasn't plummeting. We haven't seen anything close to like the 1987 or even the 1929 or 2008 type experiences. We got big, big losses. You've seen very, you know, volatility has spiked up, but it's not at levels that we saw in previous downturns. So I think the Fed likes to see this managed drawdown in asset prices. And as long as they can manage, and, you know, we can debate all day on how that, what we mean by manage, but as long as it's a controlled drawdown, I really think the Fed will keep doing what they're doing and feel comfortable doing what they're doing.
Okay, so here's the question I want to get to, which is the Fed pivots. And let's see here, I'll pull up this question here by Jax. What will the impact be? I think there's a lot of people that just have this simple equation in their mind. Things get rough, Fed pivots, and then we go back to the halcyon days we enjoyed over the past decade, where everything always goes up, you buy every dip. You know, it's just going to be, we've made it through the tough time, right? And I guess I'll make an open-ended question to you guys about what do you think will be the likely impact of a Fed pivot? And then I'll ask some specific questions around this. Michael, why don't we let you build on what you just said, and then I'll go to the New Harbor guys.
So I think the risk of the Fed pivot is if they pivot too soon, pivot before inflation really gets low, that the bond markets are going to freak out. And yields are going to shoot higher, and that will then in turn just further destroy the economy, further create the problems that the Fed was slowly trying to alleviate. So I think they run the risk that if they do pivot, if they do just stall, if inflation isn't coming down quick enough and they take a light-handed action, the bond market will be very problematic for the Fed. And it's so far the corporate bond markets and even mortgages have their spreads or the difference in their yield between those and treasuries haven't blown out. We haven't seen what we saw in 2008 and what we've seen through many other financial crises. If you start seeing corporate bond spreads rising, corporate bond yields rising much more than treasury yields, so spreads are gapping out, that becomes another problem. So the Fed has to be really careful here that they don't pivot, they don't seem too easy too soon, because the bond markets, I think, can do a lot of damage to everything they've been trying to keep controlled.
Okay, so that's the classic rock and the hard place that the Fed is stuck between, right? Inflation's really high, right? But if they keep hiking, they're going to break something, you know, either send us into a really painful recession, or they're going to break something systemically. And then we have a cascade risk to worry about.
Right.
So just give us a little bit more color on what does that look like from an asset price standpoint, if there is indeed a bond market revolt against the Fed?
I think the bond market revolt, obviously yields shoot higher. Bond prices go down markedly. Stock prices may initially do well. You know, like you said, we're getting back to the go-go days, but I think that will be very short-lived. And, you know, stock prices can't handle higher rates. If you look at over history, if you just look at price to earnings ratios, stock prices do not do well when you have higher inflation. And if the Fed is thought to be egging on inflation, trying not caring enough about inflation, multiples, price to earnings multiples and other multiples can drop sharply. Further aggravating the problems and making the Fed look very, very foolish, for lack of a better word, that they don't have control. So I think what the Fed is going to try to do is try to remain pretty tough on inflation until they're confident that it's low enough and will stay low enough to be out of the woods, because the bond market has shown that it's very temperamental at this point. And I don't think it would be very happy with the Fed that's saying, you know what, we're going to raise in July and we're going to sit back at the September meeting. Or, you know, even if they say something at their Jackson Hole conference, they're not going to, I just don't think they're going to say anything that leads anyone to believe that they're not going to do anything other than raising rates aggressively, at least for the next few meetings.
Okay. So let's see, let me go to New Harbor. John, let me go to you. So, you know, basically Michael just gave his opinions on what he thought might happen if the Fed pivots too early. I'll let you give any color to that you want to. But my question for you is what do you think is the Fed, what odds do you give the Fed of threading the needle here, which is finding that middle ground between tightening for long enough, you know, to get inflation down low enough that it can actually start easing again without re-stirring, you know, all the inflation animal spirits?
Yeah. So let's remember the Fed had for the longest time held out 2% as their magical inflation target. And they were at the time a little controversial in saying we're willing to let it run a little hot over that 2% target, right? Kind of their practice over the last decade and more of constantly moving the goalposts, right? I find it really hard to believe that they're going to completely do an about face if inflation is still at, say, 4 or 5% annualized. Because I think they realize the damage, like Michael, I think, rightly points out, the bond market would likely be very unkind to a Fed that kind of shows a lack of spine to not get the job done or mostly done. And worse than, you know, bad results is in their mind is their credibility being damaged permanently, right? If it's not already been massively and permanently already. But I think there is some real likelihood that they're going to not be so easy to pivot. And I think we're going to see. So I don't think they're going to be able to thread the needle. I don't think they're going to be able to, you know, kind of appease all masters, appease markets, appease the inflation problems that are hitting everyday people on the streets every day. I think there's going to be some carnage here. There's got to be, I think, and there is no easy out, is my quick assessment.
Okay, good. Yeah. So that's one of the things that characterizes this year is we just have these sort of swirling risks and there's no easy trade-offs, right? You know, you try to solve for one thing and you create two more problems over here and vice versa. And where I'm going with this is, we've got inflation, which is crushing households right now. We've got this risk of recession coming up. And on the path to that recession, we have falling asset prices. And a lot of people are already sitting on some pretty painful losses here. And so the Fed has this increasingly complex calculus it's got to try to think through here. Here's another one. So Mike Preston, I'm coming to you with this. And guys, I'm going to start sort of ping-ponging around now, trying to squeeze in a few more questions. So Wanda asks, essentially, all right, so the Fed's out there hiking. But what about the debt? Like, is there a debt limit here? Is there a cost of debt limit above which the economy just can't handle it? And Michael Leibowitz gave a nod to this earlier. But, you know, there are some people that say, hey, the U.S. economy can't withstand a Fed's fund rate above 2%. And some people put that at 3, some put it at 4, whatever. But Mike Preston, how concerned are you of, you know, just sort of a weakness of this highly indebted economy to just truly start buckling under what would be a historically relatively low Fed fund rate?
Yeah, I mean, I'll use some approximate numbers here. I mean, the federal debt is something like $30 trillion now. You know, it's doubled in the last, 6 years, something like that. And we're not even really technically in a recession yet. And, you know, where it's increasing at a rate of $2+ trillion a year. And what the Fed has done, I think, is completely irresponsible. You know, we talk on this program and other programs 95% of the time or more about the Fed. What's the Fed going to do? What's the reaction going to be? They've gotten themselves so intertwined in the economy and in the markets that they can't get out. They're like an octopus with a tentacle in every corner. They're trying to keep 50 spins at the end of a stick spinning like in, you know, one of those acrobat shows. I think it's irresponsible. And I think that history shows that when you take a system and you stress it that much with so many variables, that something fails. Nobody knows exactly how. And the Fed's balance sheet now is at $10 trillion, roughly. I mean, it was at $1 trillion not long ago, a little more than 10 years ago. And so nobody knows the exact number either. But as interest rates go up, there's mark-to-market losses on those assets. So the Treasury creates money, the Fed buys bonds with it, and they've got $10 trillion approximately of these bonds now. And they've got somewhere probably around $1 trillion in unrealized losses, maybe a little less, maybe a little bit more. As interest rates go up, those losses are going to increase. Those losses essentially belong to the American people. And, you know, when the Fed creates money, you know, they inject money into the system by buying all these bonds and then subsequently take losses on them. That's not really much different than fiscal policy. It kind of changes from monetary policy to fiscal policy. They've got the right to, you know, to essentially destroy wealth by these policies. I know they argue that it's for the greater good of everybody, but they usurp and bypass Congress by doing this. And they essentially become more powerful than they should be. If you just look at valuations, the raw data, statistically, valuations, again, like I said earlier, are far beyond anything they've ever been. We better be able to keep them at a permanently high plateau, because if not, it's going to be very painful and probably has to be for freedom to come back into these markets. And I know it doesn't feel good to be rooting for that process, but I, for one, would like to see some freedom and some reality and some real price discovery back in these markets. I mean, otherwise, we really wouldn't have learned anything. We would have learned that we can have our cake and eat it too, and that anything is possible and you never have to be responsible. So, yeah, I don't know the absolute limit on debt. Maybe you can go from $30 trillion to $50 trillion. At the federal level, and we'll probably try that in the next crisis, I'm sure. But ultimately, I think it will fail. And when the Fed pivots, despite what will likely be a near-term bounce in the equity markets, I think we might very well see panic and a much deeper and more panicked bear market. You know, I mean, to buy the market when the Fed pivots is not a unique idea. I talked to several people today alone that have asked that question. How can we make money when the Fed pivots? The whole world's going to be looking to do that. And we have the tools to do that in the short term and hedge it with options perhaps. But frankly, particularly if the bond market freaks out, like Michael just mentioned, it's going to be lights out for the equity market. And we'll have to look at preserving assets and being very tactical with opportunities. So it's a long-winded way of saying that, I don't think it can go on much longer, and that there's a lot of risk to the downside.
All right. Just to take a kind of a quick spin poll here. What I'm detecting from all you guys is that if the Fed, if and when the Fed pivots, let's assume they do it 3 months from now, just to pick a random date. It sounds like in terms of managing, you know, the capital you manage, it sounds like you are going to be suspicious of the positive impact that's going to have. And yes, you may, you may put some chips into play that you're holding in reserve right now, but it's going to be something you're going to be cautious. You're going to be doing it in a fairly conservative risk managed way. I don't hear from you guys that you're thinking, oh, that's when we go all in. But I don't know. Let me just dial around real quickly. John, I think I know your answer because I ask you this a lot. But
yeah, well, again, I believe that the Fed is going to be very careful to pivot too soon. And there's likely going to, as many guests on your program have put it in quotes, something's got to break, right? And I think part of the breakage before they pivot is some real, you know, damage in markets, you know, not the kind of controlled. Yeah, we're down technically close to 20% on the year on the S&P, but it's been kind of orderly and you know, certainly in the context of how things have levitated, not a lot of damage. But if you go back to prior real episodes of panic in markets, you know, look at the tech bubble, look at the housing bubble, the Fed was aggressively lowering interest rates to try to stem those sell-offs. And the fact of the matter is, once something like that happens, the Fed freaking out and panicking and getting easy doesn't stop things overnight. You know, there's a whole lot of panic and folks say, you know what? I think things are going to zero. I don't care if you lower interest rates to zero on my money market accounts. I still want to be there instead of my stocks that are dropping 3 or 4 or 5% every day, right? So I think this notion that has been beaten to everybody's head that the Fed can on a dime click their fingers and the markets start to take off, I think that's going to be proven to be a very false assumption if we get the kind of market sell-off that would likely be needed for the Fed to kind of panic, so to speak, and get pivoted.
All right, Mike Leibowitz, let's get your thoughts on that. And if you can, I put up this question here from Garrison, which is really germane to what John just said, where he said, hey, when the Fed pivots and begins lowering rates again, this would open up room for the housing market to begin climbing again, correct? And that may not be a safe assumption.
Yeah, I like what Mike said. He used the acrobat example, the you know circus type show. I think it's a game of whack-a-mole. And in the past, the way whack-a-mole economics, Fed whack-a-mole used to work is every once in a while a problem would pop up and Jerome Powell or whoever was running the Fed would knock it down. And there were really not too many consequences and they could do it easily and it worked and it was effective. And the market knew that once they whacked that prop, once they pulled out the hammer and started whacking it down, it was time to buy. Well, I think this time is very different because we added almost $5 trillion of debt in a year. During 2008, we got up in the upper like 1.7, 1.8. We've been running deficits so far beyond anything that we've run in the past without economic growth to pay for it. So I think what we have now going forward is a sped up game of whack-a-mole where the Fed is going to have choices. It can whack that one mole that's coming up, but there's three others it has to deal with. And by whacking this one, these two become problematic or vice versa. So I think the paradigm has shifted. You know, some people call it the end game. Maybe it's the, you know, the first inning of the end game. Maybe it's the fifth inning. But the problems were escalated significantly because of COVID. And what may have originally been waiting for the late 2020s or maybe even early 2030s got shifted up quite a few years because of our fiscal irresponsibility in dealing with COVID. And that's it's not just the inflation that was caused because, you know, from writing checks, printing money and giving it to people, the PPP loans and all the other things. But it's just the sheer madness of continuing and giving money to everyone and focusing solely on economic growth and not what's best. And I think the time is coming where there's just too many moles that are popping up in that machine and the Fed is not going to be able to handle them all the way it used to. So when you kind of think about, well, housing do better? Maybe, but at what expense? You know, again, if rising housing prices affects inflation, and the Fed doesn't get inflation back down to 2% or close to 2%, and in a stable manner, the market is not going to trust Powell, and you know, both the bond and the stock markets and the currency markets. So again, you know, we're not just dealing with kind of a one-trick pony type thing for the Fed to deal with here. We got bigger problems now.
Great way to say it. All right, so let's just dig into housing just for a little bit longer. We've got some specific investment questions, sort of assets that I'm going to get to in a second. But for the majority of America, their house is their biggest asset. And so where goes the housing market goes a lot of Americans' confidence in the economy. We already know that confidence is really, you know, at record lows right now, if you look at the University of Michigan report. So we're already in trouble there. But housing has, you know, a couple of real dark looking storm clouds gathering around it. One, prices got so darn high, unaffordability just became a big issue. And it's the sort of high prices, cure high prices scenario where just the demand just may start dropping off just from the high prices alone. But now we've had the cost of capital double in the mortgage market, right? So just mathematically, people can afford less house. We're talking about recession. And if it's a decent sized recession, usually job loss comes along with that. And in theory, house prices are supposed to be a function of what local incomes can support. And if local incomes get whacked, you know, that's another big issue. Of course, Michael, as you said, you know, if the Fed pivots too soon, and if inflation is still a big risk, that means household budgets are still getting, you know, eroded by that. But if the bond market revolts, that means yields continue to rise higher, which just makes that cost of capital issue even worse. So kind of where I'm going with this is what's your guys' sort of general outlook for the housing market? Do you see here better than 50% potential that housing prices may have peaked last year and may head down far enough that it starts impacting consumer behavior and sort of a negative wealth effect when they're looking at how much equity value they're losing in their homes? Michael, why don't we start with you, and then I'll bounce back to the New Harbor guys.
Yeah, the easy answer is yes. House prices got way ahead of themselves, and they got way ahead of themselves because you could get a mortgage below 3%. You get mortgage rates low enough and you can afford almost anything.
An infinite house, right? Because your debt doesn't cost you that much.
Right, in theory. I mean, you go to Japan and you get a negative mortgage rate and you can really buy a great house. So, you know, your housing market, housing affordability is largely, I mean, it's predicated on your income, but it's largely predicated on the mortgage rate. And the Fed knows that. And the Fed's been, that's part of the Fed's model. But that game is kind of over with at this point. And it's hard to see mortgage rates getting all the way back down to where they were. And incomes are pressed. So, you know, in some very wealthy areas that may, you know, we may still see some of this bubble-like pricing, but we're already seeing prices fall rapidly. And it's confidence, it's inflation, it's the fact that wages aren't keeping up with inflation. So reality, everyone's getting a pay cut, whether they know it or not. And then you throw on top of that mortgage rates that are now 5.5%, 6%, 6%+. And that's really a big problem for housing. Now, you know, if houses were fairly priced, I'd say it's a problem for housing. House prices are so far above what makes sense that it's a huge problem for housing. So everything is aggravated because the level of prices has risen way too much because of just dirt cheap money.
All right. Yeah. A huge problem for housing. And just for the folks that don't know this, your partner, Lance Roberts, a few weeks ago, put his house on the market and sold it in anticipation of what he sees as a fairly substantial downturn in the market. So he's going to rent for the foreseeable right. future until potentially better values are ahead. So he's kind of putting his money where his mouth is there. John, I'm coming to you real quickly before I do. Folks, I meant to mention this earlier. You know, for these live events, we use a different type of software. This is a different just format from the usual long form interviews that I do with usually just one guest. But if you guys have any feedback about this, if you like it, if you don't like it, whatever, just let us know in the comment section. We always love to hear whether you like what we're doing or not. Also, if you like what we're doing, please do me a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button. And if you haven't yet subscribed to the channel, click the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. All right, John, why don't I come to you? Thoughts on anything to add to Michael's big trouble ahead for the housing market comment?
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm going to try and share a chart that I came across my screen today. Let's see if we can make that happen, because I think this was an interesting let's see here. Share screen. All right. Hopefully there's a chart that shows up here. Can you see that?
There we go.
All right. Hopefully that it's kind of not showing the full thing on my screen, but this is a chart that shows by Redfin, which is a big real estate company, shows real estate deals that home buyers backed out of, right? And you can see the spike here. This, I think, is a very early indicator of the market starting to, I don't think prices have come off dramatically yet in many parts of the world, but what you're seeing is that buying demand start to get skittish, right? And every one of the when someone cancels a contract like this, they lose their deposit money. So it's not like it's without consequence. But I think what we're seeing here is, demand starting to get skittish. Sellers maybe being a little bit resistant to lower prices to, game of chicken, so to speak. I'm not going to lower my price because the housing market's still strong, and my neighbor sold their house for, $50,000 more than what you're offering a month ago. So I'm going to sit. Long way of saying, I think we're going to see softer prices ahead to, really balance supply and demand, which I think is in the early stages of correcting.
Yeah, I mean, we're barely seeing price corrections yet in the markets. We're seeing more the earlier signs of listings increasing, days on market expanding, all that stuff tends to precede price corrections. And there are actually a number of price corrections happening, but it's still, relatively minor given where we think this thing could go. Just to see that chart already beginning to jump that far this early in the process, I'll just say it's definitely attention getting. All right, Mike, I'm coming to you with a different sort of set of questions here. A lot of people asking about gold and silver. A number of different questions here, but I think sort of the general gist of them is it still a good time, or does it still make sense to own gold and silver, especially for the coming conditions that we're talking about here? I think there's, some disappointment that gold and silver didn't do even better than they've done. They hit a record high a few months back. They've come down a fair amount, but they're still not down that much from the beginning of this year. They were flat for the year until recently, which is pretty darn good compared to a lot of other assets out there that are still down a lot more than the precious metals. But I think some people feel like, this was sort of the best case scenario in my mind for these things, and they still didn't do all that well. So what do you have to say about the precious metals? But you're muted there, Mike.
I'm just trying to share my screen as I respond to that. So I'll talk through it as I'm sharing it. Gold and silver have been very disappointing, to say the least. They didn't really take the ride up the last couple of years, particularly last year when other commodities went through the roof, like cotton and grains and lumber. Most people remember seeing the chart of lumber, which has now actually backed off quite a bit. But I'm going to share the screen, and hopefully it does work so that we can see what it looks like. Okay, can we see a chart now, Adam?
Yep, we got it.
All right, so this is a monthly chart of gold. We'll just show this. This goes back about 20 years. You can see at the turn of the century, about 20 years ago, gold was trading at around $350 an ounce. And it had this giant blow-off top, kind of this parabolic move into 2011. Everyone had to have gold then, and it topped out, and then went through this long, really painful consolidation, lost almost 40% in this giant kind of triangle here. And then it broke out again. It broke out again in 19, and it topped out in August of 20. And if you take a look at this, a lot of people are talking about this whole thing here, this bowl looking thing, is a basing formation. And then gold went sideways and created the second triangle, this high level triangle. I like to think it's a bullish triangle. You might also call it a handle on this cup and handle formation. It's a very bullish chart pattern. And frankly, if you look back at 2000 to now, I mean, gold went from 350 to even today, 1729, it's performed fantastically. But it hasn't performed so fantastically for some people that have bought it, you know, particularly if you bought it back here at the recent high in 2011. And it really didn't take off with other commodities. And now it's pulling back more than we would have expected. So frankly, it's a little bit disappointing. This right here looked to be the breakout, you know, of this whole cup and handle formation. But unfortunately, at the moment, it failed and makes it look more like a short-term double top. Once we came down through this 1825 area or so, it actually went below the apex of this previous triangle. So long story short, it's pretty disappointing, but it's still way up if you've owned it the whole time. I think that you have to be a little bit fundamentally minded with gold and silver. Really, the reason old own gold and silver is because you don't trust fiat money. You don't trust central banking. We suggest that people have 10% approximately of their investable assets in gold and silver, and preferably in physical form. Truly, I do think that gold and silver will break out to the upside. It's disappointing that it hasn't yet. So this previous point has been violated, but for long-term kind of fundamental believers, I would absolutely be adding here. If you haven't bought any yet, it's a great time to add. Having said that, based on my earlier conversation about deflation, the only thing that really does worry me is if we get a deflationary impulse, then gold could easily come down another $200 or $300, you know, and then ultimately go up from there, in my opinion. So you have to be wary of you have to understand that nothing is guaranteed in life, particularly in investing. And so make sure your position size is something that you can live with. So I'll stop sharing now.
All right. Just a quick follow-up question on that, Mike. You know, given some of the concerns that you mentioned, have you guys changed any of your the way in which you're allocated, or, you know, planning on holding, buying, or selling more gold and silver? Or again, you're looking at it with that sort of fundamental outlook and you're staying the course?
For the bullion allocation that we recommend of 10%, we're staying the course. It could possibly be hedged in various different ways, but we're telling our clients to buy their position and let it sit. But we also have a position in gold mining stocks, which have equally been hurt. And that is hedged in our portfolio. We can't defray the entire downside, but we can defray some of it. And we have pretty consistent put protection on our mining position, including right now. So we prefer not to have to sell on a shakeout. Back in COVID times, in March of 2020, I think that GDX, which is the biggest ETF that holds gold miners, went from something like 29 to 15 very quickly. And we actually had put protection on at that point, and it helped us sit through that. We're kind of like in that same position again. If we have an S&P crash, GDX could go from its current 27 down to 20. It could easily happen. Yet we want to hold the position because we really, you know, based on the chart I showed you with gold, we really expect it to break out. It could break out at any time. Unfortunately, the clouds are building here. We don't know what the short-term pressures could be. We're seeing commodities prices going down across the board. That's a deflationary signal. So, and the S&P really should have an elevator drop at some point here because it's been very orderly. And if that happens, it could drag down gold stocks with it. So we continue to hold the put protection. We're trying to pay for the puts almost all of the time by selling out of the money calls. That's been successful so far. And that's still our plan going forward.
All right, Michael, coming over to you, I've got a question for you about TA, but real quick, anything to add from the RIA side about precious metals outlook?
Real quick, and we do have an allocation to gold as well. We are, in the short run, a little concerned, and I'm going to try to share my screen here, see how well I do.
All right, I love that you guys are using these new bells and whistles here.
Wish me luck here. Okay, share screen. Okay, do you see that?
I don't, sadly.
How's that?
Oh, here we go. Here we go.
Okay, so what this shows is the correlation of gold prices with real yields. So real yields are the 10-year treasury yield minus the inflation expectations for 10-year yields. And what's happened over the last 2-3 months is that real yields have gone from negative to positive. They've increased by over 1%. And as the graph shows, there's a strong correlation between gold and real yields. As real yields go more negative, the price of gold goes up and vice versa. And I think what that's showing you is the Fed's effect. Real yield should never be negative. A bondholder should never be willing to accept a negative expected yield. So when real yields are negative, and again, it's inflation expectations, not current inflation, what it's telling you, I believe, is that the Fed is heavily involved and gold prices go higher in that environment. So right now we have this anomaly where the price, as you can see it in red, has deviated from where it should be. Now, according to this, the price, you know, you could make a case for gold at 1250. I don't think it gets down there at all. You can also make a case that real yields drop significantly by a percent. That I think has a much higher likelihood. I think bond yields fall as we get a little bit of disinflation here, as we get a little more economic weakness. And as it looks like the Fed will continue to do what they're doing. So short term, we're a little cautious on gold because of this. But again, longer term, I agree with Mike and John. It deserves to have a place in a portfolio.
All right, great. Sorry, let me get back here to this view. Yep. Okay, so here is the technical analysis question I wanted to ask you. So Bob asks, how do you believe the... basically, does TA still apply in this environment, right? Does it still whatever potential predictive value, you know, it had, is it the same in this environment as it's been for the past 10 years, or because there's so much swirling now in this world, has it changed the game where perhaps TA may not be as good of a predictor as it was? So again, Michael, let me let you tackle that, and then we'll go back to New Harbor.
Yeah, I mean, I think TA does a good job, you know, and there's many, many ways to do it of showing where buyers have bought and sellers are selling and emotions. And it kind of quantifies what goes on in a lot of people's head. And just as an example, if you look at this little bounce in the S&P, it's bounced right up to levels that were prior acting as support. So people were buying it, the price would pop up, and you kind of had this flat line of support that was supporting the market. The market then broke down from there, and those are trap longs at that point. So now the market has since bounced, and we're getting back to that level, and you can see that the market is having trouble grinding higher from this point because you have all those trap longs that are wanting to get out. You know, they're happy to get their money back at best. So yes, I think technical analysis works. But I think you also have to remember the rules for technical analysis are a little different in a bear market than a bull market. Things stay oversold longer than things stay overbought. You don't need to be extremely overbought before the market goes down. It can just get back to fair value or slightly above fair value, depending on what, you know, kind of indicator you're looking at. So yeah, I you know, technical analysis should be a good part of any kind of trader's position taking.
All right. I'm looking at the time here, and boy, the time just always goes so fast during these sessions here. Like we just started like 5 minutes ago. So we'll have to start landing the plane here a little bit. Folks, if you have any really burning last questions, chuck them in here. And if I can squeeze them in, I will. Main question I'd like each of you guys to address is how are you guys deploying right now, given your outlook that you've sort of laid out for the rest of the year here, as best you can see it? And then are there any other assets that you favor that we haven't talked about so far that are worth discussing here briefly? Let's see, John, why don't we start with you?
Yep. So we just big picture, we do believe we're in kind of a downtrending market that will likely be defined by some short and furious bounces. So we are very conservative right now. We have very little equity exposure right at the moment. We do have some targets, technical targets, to kind of piggyback on the last questions, where we do think there's some increased likelihood of a broad market bounce, and we'll probably put some incremental equity exposure in at those targets, probably with hedges. You know, we do a lot with covered call option writing, things like that, which is a whole nother discussion beyond the scope of what we have time for. But yes, we think there this is an environment where shorter term tactical trading, without betting the farm, because we do think by and large prices are going to go lower from here. And simply speaking, as we get further retreats in markets for stocks and bonds or whatever you want to talk about, we would likely be wanting to add some more exposure and let those hedges or those belt and suspenders relax a little bit. And you know, there certainly is historical precedent based upon where valuations are today for markets to be 30, 40, 50% or more lower than where they are right now. Someone early on asked about if we think the GMO, Jeremy Grantham GMO's super bubble warning that markets could drop 50, 60%. It's absolutely a plausible scenario based upon history.
All right, Mike, anything to add to your partner's comments there?
Yeah, I think I'd just say that we are about as conservative as we have ever been right now. We got out of a couple of our positions a few weeks ago. One got called away for profit. The other one we took a stop loss on. So essentially we're at 55% short-term cash equivalents with zero net equity exposure. Now we could get caught flat-footed if we go vertical from here, but you have to kind of look at the set of conditions and make a call, and we are looking to buy lower. And so that's why we have so much dry powder at the moment. So that's about all I would like to add.
All right. You said something I'm going to touch on in just a second here, but before I do, Michael Leibowitz, how are you guys positioning, and any particular assets worth talking about that we haven't already?
We're also very conservative, Kurt, conservative as well. We're sitting on a lot of cash. We're using this current reflexive rally, reflexive bounce, to actually, you know, further get rid of some positions to reduce our exposure. We are increasingly liking bonds here, thinking that yields will drop from here as the economy worsens and as some of the natural forces behind inflation start to temper. Nothing really on the alternative side at this moment.
Okay. All right. So here's the question. Let's see who asked it here. I can't find it. Oh, no, here it is. Does anyone in the panel see any realistic chance of a crack up boom? So sort of the spirit of this question is as to you've told us what you think is going to happen. Try to make the argument as plausibly as you can for the opposite happening. You know, is there a chance here that there could be some sort of bullish development that justifies market participants driving financial asset prices a lot higher from here? I guess, Michael, let's start with you and then we'll go to New Harbor.
Yeah, it's hard to see that. I mean, I guess the only thing, and politically, I don't even think this is viable either, but if they, you know, start writing a bunch of checks again, inflation pops and the Fed doesn't really do much about it, you can have, you know, potentially a crack up. It won't be a nice crack up like we had in 21 with low inflation. But in theory, you know, nominal stock prices could go up significantly, although on an inflation adjusted basis could be down.
Right. And you get, you know, the pitchforks and torches in the street as people just can't afford to eat anymore.
Right. So it won't be a pretty crack up, but it could be a crack up.
Okay. Mike, Preston.
Yeah, it's hard to see it, but anything's possible. We've certainly learned that anything is possible. Some people point to a level of bearishness in the market, and they say, well, you know, markets bottom amidst a lot of bearishness. If you look at AAII, which I think is American Association of Individual Investors, if you look at the polls, you know, about their sentiment, it's you know, it leans heavily bearish. In other words, there's very few bulls. And many people say, well, look, everyone's nervous. And if the market just goes up, shorts will start covering, then it will go vertical, and then we'll have this blow off top. It's possible. I don't think it's very probable. And furthermore, it's really hard to make calls based on such a speculation, because what do you do if you're wrong? What is your risk control? You almost just have to, our choice is to stay back and watch. If you were to play such a thing, I suppose maybe you could do it with options or something, or you can just buy and hope, which we don't think is a very good strategy. So the AAII polls are kind of showing, from a contrarian standpoint, that people are too bearish. But if you look at the same AAII data and you look at what people are actually doing with their money, if you look at percent equities, they're still like 65 or 67%. They're barely off their all-time highs. So what people are actually doing with their money is staying invested in the market, maybe very short term. You know, they're providing bearish responses, but these things are horrible timing indicators. The market could easily collapse from a bearish reading and only get more bearish. So I wouldn't be making any calls on such data. And I personally think that a crack up boom is not likely, though I can never say impossible.
All right. And John, I'll let you have the last word here.
Yeah. I'll just add, you know, all of us here on this panel, unlike, you know, we're not just prognosticators. We actually work with real people and they entrust us to help us with their hard-earned assets. So we have to ask the question, is it possible? We have to go beyond that. We have to say, what is the prudent thing to do with one's life savings that they don't get another do-over, right? So like my partner said, you know, anything's possible technically, but where does the prudency come in? How much would you want to wager or bet on that crack up boom? You know, in our fiduciary capacity, with our bias, and I think it's a well-informed bias based upon many decades of history, is even if that were to happen, the counter side of that, the other side of that, picking, for example, David Hunter's forecast, which is kind of, you might say, a crack up boom, and then he calls for an 80% bust after that. You know, what are you going to do with that? You know, do you think you're going to put 100% of your portfolio in stocks on some premise of getting that perfectly right and then miss the 80% on the other side? So it's not enough to say, is it possible? It's like, what do you do with your money? And, you know, certainly we have the tools. If someone wants to, any of our clients or prospective clients want to put a little bit more faith in that scenario, then perhaps we might be otherwise inclined to recommend them too. We certainly have tools to at least bound the risk and frame the consequences of a scenario happening or not, right? So that's where the rubber meets the road for us. The management in a fiduciary way, in a very prudent way, our clients' hard-earned money.
All right. Well, that's a great way to end this. So as we do on this program every week, we underscore the fact that these markets are complex. They're heavily volatile right now. They're ever-changing. It's a really sort of treacherous time for individual investors to try to navigate, particularly on their own. So we're huge fans of recommending that people work under the guidance of a professional financial advisor in A, creating a plan that makes sense given both the market outlook, but your specific, you know, financial situation and goals and risk tolerance and all that. And then actually helping you execute that plan and trying to keep your emotions from, you know, influencing you to make the wrong decision at the wrong period of time. If you have a good financial advisor, great, stick with them. They are worth your weight in gold. If you don't, or you'd like a second opinion by one who thinks like our panel does, then we highly recommend that you reach out and talk to one. And if you don't know a good one, we will happily connect you with the firms that are here on this program with us. Doesn't cost you anything. They will sit down with you. They'll have a detailed conversation about your situation. They'll tell you what they think you should do. And you can take that information and give it to your existing financial advisor. You can execute it on your own. Or if you like what these guys have to say, you can talk with them more about potentially doing something with them. But it's totally up to you. So if that's of interest to you, just go and fill out the short form at wealthion.com. Only takes a couple of seconds to fill out. And then you can have one of those free conversations. All right. And then just wrapping up, a couple of quick resources for folks. With the team at RA Advisors, Michael Leibowitz's firm, and Lance and a few other of their partners, we will be putting on at some point in the next month a dedicated webinar all about retirement planning. We got a huge amount of demand from this audience for that. So we haven't picked an exact date yet. We're still nailing it down. But if you want to be alerted when registration for that is open, and it's going to be a free webinar, just send an email to retirement@wealthion.com, and we'll put you on the list to be alerted. Also, we talked earlier about the dangers of coming recession and the layoffs that might come along with that. If you haven't yet read it, we have a free resource. It's the Layoff Survival Guide, which basically gives you a bunch of steps that you can take right now if you work for a paycheck, if you have an employer, that you can take now to make yourself potentially less vulnerable to a layoff. But even more importantly, if you do get laid off, there's a lot of concrete steps to take in there right after you've been laid off that will help increase your situation. So if you want to go get that report, again, totally free, it's at wealthion.com/layoffs. All right, John, Mike, and Michael, thank you guys so much for joining me again this month. Everybody watching, we will do this again next month. We try to do it the first Monday of every new month. That's going to be our cadence going forward. Again, if you continue to like this new format, do me a favor, hit the like button, and then click the red subscribe button below if you haven't already, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Advisors, guys, thanks again for joining me today. And everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for watching.
Thank you.
Our pleasure, Adam. Thank you very much.